Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is Friday, September 29th. We have a great new guest today, Jay Martin. He's the host of the Jay Martin Show, also the CEO of Cambridge House, and he covers a wide variety of topics when he does podcasts on money management, geopolitics, macro finance, commodities, technology, and various emerging trends. And today we'd like to do a focus on commodities. Welcome, Jay.
Thanks for having me, Richard. I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
Great. And yeah, I just thought if you could relate a bit of background on your show and the extensive followers you have.
Yeah, sure. Love to, man. So I'm an investor first and foremost, Richard, and I do focus on the commodity sector, not exclusively, but that's where I have the largest competitive advantage, I would say. And so I spend a lot of my time inside the commodity sector. I launched the Jay Martin Show, podcast, YouTube channel, all this. Really, like, it was a very self-serving endeavor. You know, it was four years ago. I wanted to borrow more brain capital from my network when it came to my own portfolio. And I wanted to stress test my theses more diligently and all of this stuff. So, you know, I had a decent Rolodex from, you know, being in the business for about 12 years and hosting conferences. And so I started inviting on money managers 2-3 times a week to just like talk shop with, you know, and it was, here's what I'm excited about. Here's how I'm approaching it. Here's the vehicles I'm looking at. And what do you think? And sometimes, and I'd specifically, you know, sit down with people who had been in the game a lot longer than I had, you know, made more money than I had and more mistakes, all of it. Right. And they could say, well, you know, Jay, you're right on the money here, but I think you're 10 years too early and here's why, or no, you're way off track, here's what you're missing, or yeah, I completely agree and I'm pushing cash that way too. And so, you know, it doesn't make my approach foolproof, but you know, it added a new layer of diligence to my investment decisions, and it's super fun. And I didn't expect the audience to grow like it did, but at the end of the day, you know what, I'm a retail investor. And so is my audience. They're the same as me. They're just looking for the smartest home for their cash, you know? So I launched with that mission. I'm not a professional investor. I have a couple businesses, 3 kids, you know, I got about 2 hours a day where I can actually focus on my portfolio, and that's about it.
Okay. Sure.
And so my audience is kind of like that, right? They're not pro investors either. They're retail investors just looking for the smartest home for their cash. And so they've jumped along for the ride.
Yeah. Your program show is fantastic. I'm a subscriber, follow it well, and I'm just, you know, fascinated with the insightful discussions and guests you have on your show.
I appreciate that. It's a blast, to be honest. I'm the biggest beneficiary. Like, I get the most out of it, for sure. Yeah.
Great. So yeah, today, I know you've been a bull on commodities, so just wondering if we could explore that in a bit more detail. What your thoughts are on the commodities trend in general, where you see you know, commodities going in the next short term, medium term, long term, and what you see the main key drivers are in this bull market.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I think there's a couple factors at play here worth paying attention to, and the first is just basic supply and demand dynamics. It doesn't really matter which direction you look in the commodity sector, but especially if you're looking at hard commodities like metals, these are industries that have been massively undercapitalized for 12 to 15 years. Our demand has not slowed down for any of the raw materials that our world produces, but our investment in the extraction of those has ground to a halt more or less relative to, you know, 15 years ago. And, you know, you can look at the oil sector, you can look at a variety of energy, you can look at copper, nickel, et cetera, you'll find the same trend. And markets are cyclical. The last 12 years, it's been great to have been a speculative growth investor, you know, and a lot of money has been made there. Any investor who entered the game within the last 12 years has kind of learned the same lesson, right? It's that the broad equities market goes up, you know, and Sometimes it corrects and then it goes up again. And, you know, jumping on the bandwagon, chasing high prices, as silly as it sounds, has been a good enough strategy for a lot of investors to get by over the last decade. But, you know, as you know, you look back a little further in history and you see these things move in cycles from value to growth, growth to value to growth, et cetera, et cetera. And so from a basic supply and demand standpoint, I'm very bullish on the commodities sector for that reason. And, you know, demand really just moves one direction. I was, you know, we'll probably end up talking about the energy sector today, but I'm very bullish on energy right now. And if I hear voices that are counter to that, just high level, it often comes in the back of, well, yeah, you know, demand is going up, but we're also looking at probably some kind of pretty deep recession in our near future here, maybe globally coordinated recession. And on the back of any coordinated recession like that, you're going to see massive demand destruction. And as demand goes down, prices fall as well, which on the surface sounds like it makes sense. But when you look at oil consumption, you know, over the last 20 years and analyzed years like the 2008 financial crisis, you know, oil consumption on a global level fell by just over 1% during the great financial crisis, the biggest financial crisis of my lifetime. I mean, during 2020, when we had everybody locked in their homes and, you know, trains were stopped in the tracks, airplanes were grounded, cars were in garages, global oil consumption dropped by 8%, like single digit, and it bounced back real fast. So, you know, us as a species, we're moving one direction, and that's towards more consumption because we're ambitious, busy, hungry, thirsty little animals, you know? And so on the back of that, it's a pretty bullish outlook for commodities. But over the last few years, you know, specifically since 22, there's been some geopolitical events that add a lot of fire to that thesis. And what I'm talking about is that, you know, my entire life has been the era of increased globalization, right? Like continuous sharing, more and more sharing of the raw materials that the world needs, sort of an era of trust on a global level, fragile as it might have been. It was trust enough that whatever materials a country needed, if they had the cash or the credit, they could purchase from the global marketplace. It was all available to us. And that era, I believe, has come to a close. I don't think whatever happens next is going to be simple, you know, quick or predictable, but we're definitely moving into the next era of history. And one thing I feel quite certain about in that era is that countries are going to be a lot more guarded with the materials that they have access to and the resources that they have access to. And so this puts a massive emphasis on the importance of securing supply right away, because you used to be able to buy your energy metals from China, no longer. You used to be able to buy raw nickel from Indonesia, no longer. Countries are guarding what they have. And so the consumers of all of these, you're going to have to get real serious, real fast about building the right alliances, investing in the right countries and projects to secure their supply chains, because nothing's guaranteed anymore. And this rush to gain supply chain security is gasoline on an already heavily weighted supply and demand, bullish supply and demand dynamic in the commodity sector. So a few more complexities today to look at that didn't exist 5 years ago, but they're bullish, absolutely.
And those are great statistics on the oil sector, and a great observation on what's happening with commodity producers and the supply chain challenges. Are you bullish on particular sectors in the commodities complex, like agricultural commodities, industrial commodities, precious metals, energy?
Yeah, from a high level, Richard, for the reasons that, you know, we discussed, just the supply chain security standpoint, I'm pretty bullish in general. However, you know, when it comes to allocating capital, I stay in my lane, right? So I could look at agriculture. 25% of the world's grain market comes from Russia and the Ukraine. You know, I don't invest in ag commodities, but like I understand why people are very excited about ag commodities right now. I tend to stay where I have a competitive advantage. So even though I think the price of food is going to go up, you know, it's not an area where I have a competitive advantage. And so I like to play the stack deck, to be honest with you. Right. And my guests on my show, my conference, my newsletter, it's all focused on the metals market. So I do look there. You know, from an energy standpoint though, right now, there's some really interesting things occurring. I think, oil prices are going up. Diesel prices have hit all time highs for this time of year. Diesel prices are up 60% in Europe just since the summer. And everybody's focused on the recent Saudi and Russia supply cap. They've extended the supply cap extensions up until the new year here. But just last week, Russia also quietly announced a limit on the export of diesel. And we're already struggling to make enough diesel in the world. And, you know, the significance of that is that, you know, when the price of diesel goes up, the price of everything goes up. You know, when the price of energy goes up, the price of everything goes up. It's the universal inputs, anything you want, if you have to grow it, manufacture it, or move it. And I don't really see, I'm trying very hard, right now, Richard, to see an avenue where we don't have massive price inflation this winter and even spring, you know, and I don't really see a way we don't experience that because, you know, oil prices are climbing, diesel prices are already at all-time highs. Russia just extended more limits on export of diesel and gas in addition to oil production. The only non-OPEC growth that's really made a difference over the last 12 years has been U.S. unconventional shale. And according to last month's EIA report, that's now rolled over and we're now declining production pretty steadily month over month. And October's forecast is less than September's, et cetera. The Permian Basin, which has contributed the most to that growth, is now rolled over and producing less and less each month. Now, whether that's due to undercapitalization or tapped resource, doesn't really matter because it's not going to increase anytime soon. It takes time for that to turn around. And so it's no coincidence. Like the average American or Canadian might not be reading the EIA inventories, but I guarantee you the Saudis and the Russians are, and they're capitalizing on this opportunity to squeeze the energy market big time. And so on the back of that, I think we'll see a lot of price inflation across the board, ag products, wherever you look. My personal portfolio, I'm more exposed to the metals. And so right now I'm quite exposed to gold and silver producers. My rationale there, Richard, is not necessarily because I believe the market's going to take off this quarter or next quarter. I don't try to time markets, but I do know when things are cheap. And I look at, you know, I can right now walk into very high quality mid-tier gold producers producing between 250 to 500,000 ounces per year with a clear path to a million, run by great management teams with a couple successes in the back pocket already, and nobody cares. It's a very hated market right now because there's just no risk capital available for these guys. So, you know, it's a contrarian bet only because if you look at the liquidity in these companies, it's very, very low. It strikes me as odd that would be a contrarian bet right now, but it seems to be. I think it's only a matter of time before that shifts. When it does, the precious metals sector tends to shift pretty quickly, and so I'm building my positions today.
So it sounds like you have a focus from the equity side, right, to invest in the commodities. Any interest or preference or ideas in like futures and options in the commodities way to play this?
I don't play in the futures market, Richard. Again, too frequently, I think I see investors getting a bit more complex than is necessary and getting over their skis in terms of their portfolio activities. Sure. And I mean, if that's your area of expertise and you're good there, go for it, right? But where I look for upside, I've got a very simple portfolio, very barbelled, boring, safe, stable assets on one side. That's the bulk of the portfolio. Nothing in the middle, nothing in the broad equities market. And then on the other side, I'd like to go earlier stage, higher risk, junior producers and developers in the metal sector. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Good words of wisdom. You mentioned earlier on Saudi, Russia cutting production. You think this represents like a geopolitical risk on investing in commodities? Are they doing it because they're looking to counter U.S. Federal Reserve policy, right? The idea of the Federal Reserve trying to use monetary policy to address the challenges of rising commodity prices. So is this something geopolitical that the Saudis and the Russians are doing?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I believe so. I mean, countries will weaponize what they have access to. And the United States has access to the world reserve currency. And we've got a lot of leverage there, right? Confiscating $600 billion of USD reserves from Russia was a bold statement. And I think really changed the game. And it's not lost to me how every other central bank around the world is going to view that decision, right? And we're seeing this and how they're reshuffling their treasuries and their reserves. We're seeing a bit of a exchange of US dollars for gold. Central bank gold buying's been rocking. I'm probably not up to date with the most recent quarter's numbers, but you know, we were averaging about 1,200 tons per year central bank gold acquisition, which is colossal. That's sort of a 40-year record. Why would central banks be looking to make that shuffle? It's because the asset they've always had confidence in, they've now got a question, right? How secure is this asset? So, you know, if you're in Russia, like what's the currency that you are able to weaponize? It's not rubles, right? It's oil, it's energy, right? Last year at my conference, I had former Prime Minister Stephen Harper on my stage, and he had this haymaker quote. He said, look, you know, he's very, you know, dealt very closely with Putin during his time in office. And he said, don't be confused. Russia is a gas station run by the mafia. Now it's like a crude statement, right? But it's, you know, it speaks to, you know, how maybe we should think about the political decisions that come out of the Kremlin, right? So, and while Russia might be squeezing access to energy for Europe and the West, they've also announced they'll be selling gas to China at 50% the cost they'll be selling to Europe this winter. And so, yeah, those alliances really matter right now. And, you know, if you look at the historical rise and fall of empires, when an empire falls, it generally does not fall to one nation. It falls to a collection of smaller nations who have bound together and they found leverage collectively. And I mean, you could call that the BRICS. There's a variety of ways to look at that. But yeah, there's absolutely attempts being made in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a key trend earlier, the securing of supply chain on commodities. So with BRICS and BRICS Plus and, you know, some are using the term Global South as a dividing and trending multipolar world. What are your thoughts on how to invest in that environment? So if you think we have the Global South versus maybe like WEF, World Economic Forum countries, or Five Eyes countries in Western Europe, you know, like is it safe to invest in places in the Global South that are sort of on the edge of both worlds? Or, you know, how do you look at that? Or is it you prefer sticking to World Economic Forum, Five Eyes type of countries?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't think there's a simple answer to that. I think there's always inherent risk, especially right now. There's more geopolitical risk than there's been since I started investing in the commodities market in 2009. You know, a country that I spend a lot of time in is Indonesia. And on the one hand, you could look at their activity towards the nickel sector. You know, they put a ban on nickel exports, as we mentioned maybe before we hit record here. It's not necessarily a ban on nickel, but it's a ban on raw nickel export. And so they want to refine in country. They want to keep that margin. You know, their gain is so their gain is somebody else's expense in that regard. And they're making the same moves in the copper sector, I believe in cobalt as well. And you could look at that decision as a bit of a threat to investors and say, oh, they're moving towards nationalization and greater control and all this. You know, simultaneously, they're actually being, they're encouraging all sorts of very favorable visa programs for people like me to move to Indo and raise my family there, build my business there. And, you know, it's from a tax standpoint, from a residency standpoint, they're attracting a lot of business owners, entrepreneurs, you know, and I'm quite bullish on the Indonesian economy, actually. And as the world's largest exporter of nickel, I believe, you know, they've got the hand to be played there. So I think you got to look at each country individually. How I qualify, because geopolitics are pretty hard to predict and endlessly complex. For myself, Richard, I'll look at the individual company more so than the jurisdiction. And when I look at the company, I'm really looking at the management teams. And so if I'm looking at, you know, a gold developer, a silver producer, a copper explorer, whatever it is, my qualifier isn't necessarily the country or state that it's in. It's always the who is running this organization? Who have they surrounded themselves with? What have they done in the past? That matters to me more than anything else because, and I get it, you know, I talk to people for a living. I have a podcast, I have a conference, like I'm in the people business and that is my competitive advantage. But if you're able to isolate the winners in the commodity business, then you provide yourself a handful of insurance policies because, you know, you're betting on the expertise of people who have experience. Like, you know, you want to invest in the Congo, for example, it's probably a bad idea unless you're investing with Robert Friedland, right? He's excelling and always has, you know, and there's certain individuals who can just outperform in their area, right? You want to go into Argentina, it's pretty high risk unless you're with the Lundins, you know, and there's lots of examples of that. And so I always start with the people and, you know, I could be criticized from commodity investors who focus more on the geology or focus more on international relations. Sure. But you know, I play my hand. This is the hand that I have and I can do diligence on people. I can look at resumes and track records and find, you know, so-and-so's already exited three companies. This is their fourth. Success tends to beget success. Good people attract good people, all of this stuff. It's a very risky business. So you want to be betting on entrepreneurs who you have a lot of confidence, have a plan C because A and B will probably fail, right? If you're looking at early stage stuff. And so, you know, I start there and I start with the flesh, man. And then I get into the geopolitical concerns after that.
Well, those are great points, you know, the necessity for good management, which, you know, leading to good governance and financial management overall for the companies. And you mentioned back on Indonesia, I actually lived there myself, 1995, 1996, setting up two internet service providers during that time. Businesses there in Indonesia, great country. And do you think, as an example, if we look at Indonesia, one of those countries that seems to be straddling both sides, you know, Global South BRICS versus you know, World Economic Forum Five Eyes countries, do you think that's safe, or will they trend over time to the Global South side? And And it, could it become difficult for people in Canada, U.S. To invest in Indonesia on that basis?
Probably. Yeah, probably. And I think you're right in that maybe today they're straddling. But, you know, as conflict matures, it gets harder and harder to be a moderate. You know, and the old adage during the French Revolution, it was the moderates who got the guillotine. Like, there's some lessons in there. You know, it gets harder to straddle that fence as conflicts mature. Right now, Indonesia is doing a great job. It's going to be pretty tough to avoid the pull of the Global South, you know. And I think they're waiting to see what occurs here. You know, and I actually don't know which way Indonesia voted during the UN. You know, the UN votes every year, last 2 years anyways, on whether or not they should condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And it was like 141 voted to condemn, 38 voted to or just abstained or just voted no. And you can look at that and say, oh, they're voting on Russia and Ukraine. But really, I see it as a proxy vote. They're voting, they're either pledging allegiance to the US or to China with that vote. And so on a global level, in 22 and 23, you had around 141 countries pledge allegiance to the United States, 38 pledged allegiance to China. But in reality, it was like 8 pledged allegiance to China and 30 abstained. They weren't quite sure which camp they wanted to jump in yet. And we're going to see a lot of that moving forward. And it's too early to say, like, where is Indonesia going to land in 20 years here? You know, I mean, I got 3 young kids. So when you talk about investing in a country like Indonesia, whether from an equity standpoint, from a real estate standpoint, you know, I'm thinking about where I might lay the foundation for my kids and therefore my grandkids. And it's real hard to predict what might occur, you know, 10, 20 years down the road. And so stay nimble right now. I mean, that's, you know, that's why I like the barbell approach. It's like I can speculate and be aggressive over here, but I do so from a position of strength. You know, build the moat before you try to build the castle mentality.
Mm-hmm. And other countries where you might invest, like on the mining companies you mentioned earlier, is there any risk management considerations that you provide for actual nationalization of whatever it is, precious metals, copper, or export prohibitions? This being different from what you mentioned earlier with the commodities producers moving up the value chain, like Indonesia with nickel. Yeah, just your thoughts on that, you know, for risk management.
Outside of what I've shared, Richard, I'd say I'm pretty exposed to Canada right now. I've got some big positions in Saskatchewan in the uranium sector. And it's strictly from a mineralization standpoint. I think that we're going to need a lot more uranium in the future. There's only a few places to get it. And the second most rich basin in the world is in Saskatchewan, Canada. And so I'm quite exposed there. I think that any near-term political complications that may exist in Canada will eventually get displaced by business. I think that's the inevitable outcome. I'm quite exposed to companies in the precious metal sector through Idaho, through Nevada. So very close to home. They're safe bets. I mean, Nevada is arguably the best gold jurisdiction in the world and has been for quite a long time. And so those aren't necessarily geopolitically risky bets. And I'm going more aggressively into those locations right now. If I look through my portfolio, there's definitely less global diversification than there used to be. I'm not shying away from it, but you know, to answer your question, I am consolidating closer to home, closer to governments who have a track record of, you know, being predictable and just. You know, you could ask all kind of questions about, you know, how predictable or just is the Canadian or American government, but it's a relative question, I would say, relative to where, you know, that's what we're dealing with. So.
But yeah, at least geographically from your perspective, yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. Very strategic on the uranium in Saskatchewan, right? Given what's happening internationally, right, in the uranium market.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I'm also quite exposed to Mexico, I should say. And again, leading with entrepreneurs, I always start with the people. But got quite a lot of silver exposure in Mexico. And I feel good about that. You know, Mexico recently became U.S. largest trading partner, supplanting China. Their alliance is, you know, very obvious which direction they're headed. And given as comfortable as you can be right now at geopolitical risk, I feel good about that.
Mm-hmm. And a question on the effect of bond, U.S. Treasury bond prices and the U.S. dollar. You know, there's been a lot of volatility in that recently, and both the bond prices and U.S. dollar valuation recently. What are your thoughts on that and how it affects commodity prices in general, with, you know, most commodities priced in U.S. dollars? There's been a lot of selling, right, of the bonds by foreign countries outside of U.S. And you know, will the Fed step in and do that, or will there be financial repression from other encouraging the citizens through 401k RSP in Canada to put, you know, funds to apply to bonds? But you know, outside of that potential, just, you know, what's happening recently and the effects on the commodity prices?
Well, I don't have many examples of government being unwilling to print their way out of a problem. And so I think that, you know, birth, death, taxes, and money printing are the guarantees that we have in life, you know. So I expect monetary inflation to continue. Absolutely. How that impacts commodity prices, bullish, I suppose, you know, just as they're priced in U.S. dollars. And that's just basic monetary inflation. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
More of that.
Well, great. Awesome. It's been a very insightful discussion. You brought up a lot of great points, great perspective. Any final thoughts? And also, how can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work?
Well, we actually, we just put together a course. I wouldn't mind mentioning if I could, Richard.
Oh, yeah.
So
go ahead. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, I focus on the commodity sector, we produce a very large commodity investment conference and the podcast, et cetera. I've gotten a surge of requests from investors over the last 12 months asking how to begin investing in the commodity sector and how to begin constructing a portfolio. And as you know, there's like 100 different ways you could answer that question, and they could all be right depending on that individual's risk tolerance, available capital, and time horizon. So what we've done is we created what we call the Commodity University. And this is like a 101 workshop on understanding the supply and demand dynamics in the commodity sector. We do deep dives into sort of five major buckets in the commodities landscape, looking at gold, silver, copper, uranium, and energy metals as a whole, and then right into portfolio construction. It's definitely a beginner course. I mean, chapter one covers what is a commodity, and you know, 10 chapters later, you're building a portfolio. But I'm very excited to get this in the hands of investors because I'm seeing sentiment shifts. I'm seeing a lot of new capital arrive in the sector. And I saw way too many investors get cleaned out in 2021, 2022, that were just rushing into the market blindly. And so, you know, we built this resource to arm investors to move with diligence and intelligence. People can check it out at thecommodityuniversity.com. If you want to have a look, it's thecommodityuniversity.com. Super basic 10 chapter video course. I love it. Outside of that, I'm the Jay Martin Show, YouTube, Spotify, easy to find.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much, Jay. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.